organized this way that it can't be an operator, and in any event, in this case, it's bound by contracts with the operators, Holiday Inn or whoever they are, to operate these motels, and it can't tell them what to do.
And that, you just hit on one of the most important common questions for the class that is central to the validity of each class member's claims. And I think it's important to remember that under the Supreme Court's decision in Amgen and this Court's decision in Stockwell, the answer to the question of whether the REIT's provisions or the management agreements limit the injunctive relief that can be entered in this case is a merits question, and it's not something that ought to be decided on class certification. The point for class certification is that this vital question, central to the validity of each class member's claims, is something that can be answered in this case that therefore establishes the commonality requirements. One of the things that I want to return to is the two reasons that the district court gave for finding that class certification had to be denied here. One of those is that unless our class challenged a uniform official unlawful company policy or sued under a statute that specifically required HBC to implement a policy, that class certification has to be denied.
Those things don't have to be redressable under 23b2, I think it is. There has to be something you can do about the problem with injunction, and if these real estate investment trusts are all bound by contracts with operators that say you operate it however you like, we have nothing to say about operation, then no matter what a court wants the defendant to do, it couldn't do it, which means an injunction couldn't do the plaintiff's any good.
Given, of course, that again assumes the answer to the merits question, which is that the REIT provisions and the management agreements trump the requirements of the ADA. Let's assume that's something that ought not be decided on class certification. Let's assume that is the answer that this court arrives at. There's still a number of injunctive provisions that the district court could enter, as we identified in our briefs, that would be consistent both
in your office building, and your tenant in your office building, and our lease is just to pay me the rent, and I have nothing to say about how you run your office. And then one day I come to you and I say, I'm really upset, you need to run any domestic relations. I want you to make 20% of your practice domestic relations. You'll tell me to get lost.
Again, assuming that those provisions from the ADA, we identified using a management agreement that was submitted by the defendant, in which they asserted was typical of their management agreements, relief that would be consistent with the provisions of those agreements, because each one of those agreements includes a requirement of law provision that says the operators, the management companies, will comply with all requirements of law, and if they don't, then HBT has the right to notify them of this, and if the management companies don't bring their hotels into compliance, that's grounds for termination. So even if we
use
we believe that the REIT provisions and the management agreements don't trump the ADA, so what we would look for is an injunction requiring specific implementation of operational and training policies along the lines of what was approved by this court in Armstrong. So, for example, we would want them, because many of their hotels contract or use third parties to provide accessible transportation. Often those third parties don't even operate under the same hours that the hotel transportation is available for non-disabled persons. So one thing that an injunction would require is for them to take an inventory of which third parties they use, see whether or not the hours and other terms correspond with the hours available for non-accessible transportation, and if not, start finding additional people to provide accessible transportation. That is one thing. The other part is the training. It does no good for a hotel that actually has accessible transportation if their employees don't know about it and tell disabled potential guests that they don't have accessible transportation. So Armstrong injunction approved by this court, we would seek something that required the themselves to engage in training. And then finally, some sort of monitoring to make sure that this is continuing to comply. If we lose on the substantive point about whether the REIT provisions of the management agreement trump the ADA, we would seek an injunction along the lines of what I was just mentioning to Judge Kleinfeld, which is they use the provisions of their management agreements that say that they must comply with law, notify the management companies that their hotels are not complying with law, telling them to bring it into compliance if they don't terminate the agreements. One more point on the reasons that the district court gave. It said that it would have to, in order to enter injunction in this case, look at every potential violation at every one of the 142 hotels at issue here. And that's incorrect for a couple of reasons. First of all, this court has held that while the scope of the injunction should correspond with the scope of the violation, and thus for a systemic injunction, we need to show pervasive violations of the statute. That doesn't require a district court to look at every potential violation. Thus, for example, in the Oregon Advocacy Center case, this court affirmed an injunction covering jails in 36 counties based on evidence of jails in 7 counties. And in Armstrong, which was a case challenging the accommodations provided to disabled prisoners and parolees, you know, all across the state in connection with parole revocation hearings, the district court's evidence looked at the experiences of only 17 disabled parolees and prisoners. So the concept here is that you can use symptomatic evidence to enter a systemic injunction, and it doesn't require the court to separately address all 142 hotels. More importantly, and this is a class certification,
what would you tell the hotels, or what would you require hospitality property trusts to tell the hotels? I mean, some are in clusters, some are near the airport, some are in freeway intersections, some are downtown, big towns, small towns. Some use vans, some use limos.
With respect, those are distinctions without a difference in purposes.
You can tell them generally, follow the law. What could you tell them beyond that? I mean,
you can tell them the kinds of things I was just mentioning, which is these folks, we've established, based on undisputed evidence, that all 142 hotels are subject to the equivalent transportation requirements. That means that they need to provide accessible transportation that's equivalent to the transportation that they provide non-disabled people. You would instruct the management companies to inform HBT exactly what accessible transportation
is. It just has to be just as good as what they give people that don't have the disabilities. The easiest thing for the hotels to do is say, okay, we're eliminating our transportation for guests, people are just on their own. They can take cabs, get in the cab line, whatever they want.
They can do that. They haven't done that.
But if there was reason to, because the law made it harder for them to provide the free vans, why would you choose to do that?
They might do that. And this is a non-discrimination.
Why wouldn't that mean that commonality is even more of a problem? Providing transportation, so far.
Because if they aren't providing transportation, then they're not subject to the requirements.
That's right.
But that's not a commonality.
In these cases where the bathroom and the restaurant wasn't wheelchair accessible. So what the owner of the restaurant did was just wall off the bathroom. Its employees only know it can go to none of the patrons can go to the bathroom.
You know, I only have a moment left, but in the spectrum of difficult class actions and easy class actions, this is much more on the easy side. If you compare this, for example, to this court's class certification decisions in Parsons and Armstrong, the questions there are much more complex than those that are here. And remember that under Walmart, we just need to identify one common question crucial to the validity of each claim that can be solved in one stream. And we've done that. We've identified numerous such claims. The provision certain point, the question
you can't tell, you can't get an injunction that says they all have to provide wheelchair accessible transportation because they don't have to provide transportation at all.
So we can get an injunction that says if they have hotels that provide transportation, they need to provide equivalent accessible transportation. And that's not an unknown kind of injunction. I see my time is up, and hopefully I can have a couple minutes or so. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. David Raisman for the Senate and the Appellee and Hospitality Properties Trust. Sorry, I'm projecting, I think, here. Plaintiffs in this case have chosen not to sue multiple operators who actually operate this hotel and make decisions about whether to have transportation services, how to provide those services. And it's that failing and some others that prevents there from being commonality.
Could you deal with something raised by your adversary in argument? The implication of his argument is that the commonality is that there's just one defendant that owns all the properties, and you can tell that defendant to make sure that if his operators provide transportation, that it be accessible.
Your Honor, that's, if I may, sort of what could be told to Walmart in the Dukes case. Walmart had an obligation not to discriminate under Title VII. Whether it was monitoring its various managers flown around the country or not, it clearly had a respondeat superior duty to make sure there was no Title VII discrimination. But the failure there and here is the same. So we had multiple managers. We would argue we have a better case, but I'll get to that in a second. But even accepting we control these managers, which we don't, or had even the power to control them, like Dukes, there's no clue that holds the decisions of these multiple managers together. And that's the feeling of commonality here that can't be done. We think further, and as the court knows, we've argued that it's not the duty of the owners of the hotels, but the operators. Congress used specifically different language in 12182 on that point.
Counsel, how far could the REITs go in farming out their discrimination? Could they say, cheap store operators don't allow African Americans to stay there? That's not our problem, it's the managers. Or that there's some of the operators don't allow same-sex couples to stay. That's not our discrimination, that's the operator. Where does that end?
Your Honor, in this particular case, I think it ends in 12182, B2B, and B2C. But I think I have other responses as well. Those particular provisions say it's the operator that has responsibility for providing transportation services. But even going beyond that, this is not a liability case. And other than that statutory argument, HBT is not arguing, never argued, and the district court didn't rely on at all the notion that it's not liable. The question is whether there's sufficient clue between these.
So my point is, the REITs can make money and get the windfalls of their corporate structure by simply saying, this is hands off. We farm out these management contracts, and it's up to those managers to do what they please.
Your Honor, I would analogize to the Bodison case. In Bodison, which is the case that the plaintiffs, the appellants, actually say, there's the principle that you cannot contract away your liability or your responsibilities under statute, if I may interpret Your Honor's question in that light. The difference here is that HPT, as a REIT, has no operational ability. It's a creature of Congress. It's not a mistake, and it's not a mistake in the hotel context either. They specifically created these TRS entities to own hotels. And they specifically told them, you may not operate the hotels. So when the REIT comes to the process of owning a hotel, it is specifically doing all operational hands tied behind its back. It cannot do it. It's not done anything improper. It's not turning a blind eye to it. It's simply unable by its very nature.
It gets inside with more contrary to the management of hotels.
It does get to do that, Your Honor.
And it's unhappy with their management. They can contract the next time, or if it's a breach of the contract to follow the law, they can break the contract, can't they?
They could do that, Your Honor. I would posit that that's a very difficult step to take, and they're going to be involved in litigation over any termination.
The non-renewal incident, that's the answer.
The non-renewal begs the next question, which is pointed out by this court, I'm sorry, the U.S. Supreme Court in Asarco, and also by this court in Clanton, that just getting rid of the problem operator does nothing to ensure that third parties not before the court are going to do anything to comply with the law. In Asarco, it was the closed school trust funds that they were saying were being used for improper purposes, and the plaintiffs were arguing put those monies back in the school trust funds, and the Supreme Court held that that will do nothing to compel the Arizona legislature in this case to supplement, further supplement its funding in schools. They could just increase it now that there's more money in the school trust funds. Same thing in Glenn. It was the charge that benefit plans were charging too much money to the employer sponsor of the plans for prescription drugs. Again, the plaintiffs were arguing, put that, charge them less, and that will lower our benefit, lower premiums, lower co-pays. But there's nothing the parties could do in that case to ensure that these health plans would reduce premiums or reduce co-pays. They were asked third parties, not before the court, to prevent redressability, in my opinion, also affect commonality and the availability of a B2 injunction. A lot of these issues tend to merge together when you get down to the analysis. But importantly, even if the REITs had the obligation to operate under 12182, B2B and B2C, and even if they also were found to not be able to contract away that responsibility, which is something, even with those two caveats, even with those two stipulations, there's nothing here that shows these multiple operators have anything in common. There's nothing about an experience at one hotel in front of one operator who's not even identified. There's no attempt by the plaintiffs or their expert to identify who the actual manager was. I think Dr. Quinn's testimony is very revealing in this way, Your Honor, because Dr. Quinn testified that he didn't know what management policies were being used. He didn't know what was training, and he admitted in his deposition that he was unable to conclude whether it was poor hiring practices, whether it was poor policies, whether it was poor training, or anything else. And of course he couldn't do it, because he hadn't asked any questions about that. And there is zero proof in the record, in this appellate record, and even the record below I would represent, that talks anything about training or policies or anything else. There's simply no clue to hold the acts of these different hotels together. And we would say that recovery is not redressable in this court without the managers in the courtroom.
I'd like to spend terms of your need for class action against the common owner, but not the centric operator.
I'm sorry, I must have missed the first part of your question, Your Honor.
Why would there be a class action against the common owner rather than the separate operators? They've been trying to think of a reason, leaving them out, and seeking to deal on a necessary or indispensable party. Litigation to follow if the case survived. And the best thing I've been able to come up with is what the balance lawyer hinted at, which is that's how you get your commonality. There's just one commonality.
There's commonality among the different hotels managed by the same manager. So within any particular grouping of hotels, a manager operates 30 hotels, 20 hotels, however many hotels. There may be commonality. What there isn't, and there may not be, by the way, and there's no evidence in the record at all on the subject. One of those managers that manages 30 hotels. sales could be completely hands-off, or another manager might be particularly, he's a good manager, I'm going to let him manage the hotel the way he does it. There's no evidence to suggest that the way one manager operates the hotel is the same as any other management companies and how they operate the hotel. So finding a violation in any particular location doesn't tell us anything about the cause for that violation. And if we may borrow from the prior argument, these are wet streets correlating with the rain, Your Honor. Just finding, based on one call and on 20 occasions, two calls that conflict with the first call, that people didn't provide the right answers when asked about equivalent transportation services doesn't tell you what's causing this. And in particular, it doesn't tell you what's causing it when you don't know which hotels are operated by which managers. There's simply no attempt to tie any of these facts together. And Dr. Quinn even admits that it could be training, it could be hiring protocols, it could be bad policies, it could be bad employees. Any of those factors could affect it. How would the court? So for example, citing Armstrong, Mr. Fox argued that you'd be able to have symptomatic evidence and you can have a systemic injunction. I'm not so sure that that's still good law after Dukes, at least in the Armstrong case. But even if it were, we had a single actor in that case with uniform policies that were being challenged. We don't have that here.
But is it better why they're not providing legal service as opposed to the fact that they're not providing legal service on disabled hotels?
Well, Dr. Quinn posits that it's lack of training and lack of policies.
What difference does that make? Either you're doing it or you're not doing it right.
That would be important. That's right, Your Honor. If the hotel is not providing, it's not important. But if you're going to frame an injunction, particularly the injunctions of the type that have been suggested by the appellants, it ought to address the issue. And we'll have no understanding. And this is where we come back to the mini trial, and this is where we distinguish Armstrong and Oregon advocacy. But you can't get a systemic injunction because it will end up being an obeyed law type injunction unless we start to understand what caused each of these hotels under each of these different managers to violate the law.
I guess they've already got a provision. It sounds like it's the usual provision, so that if the landlord in the hotel you lease to starts having prostitution, gambling, and drugs on premises, you can evict them and conform to the law, clause in the lease. And I suppose we could say, well, that applies to equal access for disabled people, too. And as the appellant's lawyer suggested, you know, so far we're not in any mini trial. What would the mini trials be about?
I think the mini trials, if we're going to fashion injunctive relief, would be about what caused the wrongs to occur.
I see. You need a mini trial to decide whether for the Holiday Inns it's like a policy, and for the Staybridge Inns it's like a training.
And your guess is as good as mine because it's completely speculative, Your Honor. It may be that even between hotels with the city manager, there would be different issues. I do believe that we should defer to the judgment of the trial court. This is well within the trial court's discretion.
It's the view of abuse of discretion of de novo.
That's right, Your Honor. In particular, on an issue like this, an issue of how to fashion an injunction, those are issues that are squarely within the discretion of the court's equitable power. And when you're trying to decide, will this issue drive the resolution of dispute with respect to commonality, we should again defer to the trial judge that much more because it's a determination that's going to be about how one is going to determine liability in this case. Your Honors haven't asked, and there's been absolutely
for one group of hotels, we're going to say something like, you're required to train all employees within 3 weeks and they're starting their jobs, and for another hotel, it would be you're required to change your policies so you, at least one of your six vans
vendors that sit here today why we don't have claims against managers, because I suspect there's zero evidence of this, by the way, that managers do have common ways of operating the hotels they manage and of controlling this transportation service issue. But we don't know that. We only begin to see, Your Honor. So, yes, not only would we need separate injunctions to cure the problem, we would need many trials to understand the problem so that we could draw up an injunction. With the time I have left, Your Honors, I would only ask that we make clear that this court is allowed to reach merits issues where they overlap with the issues. Amgen stands for the idea of not having a sense of many trials to do that, but no one is asking for any of that here. With that, I would ask the court to please defer to the district court in affirming the denial of class certification.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Which brings it to Judge Wardlaw's point about the reason why these hotels do not comply is irrelevant under the ADA. What matters here is that they are subject to a statutory and regulatory requirement, that they provide equivalent transportation requirements, and that they train their employees about these transportation systems. Dr. Quinn called 138 hotels. Of those, more than 100 said that they provide transportation services generally, but they don't provide any accessible transportation services whatsoever. That is a violation. It doesn't matter what's going on at the hotels that results in that violation. It's a violation.
Mr. Fox, how do you respond to Mr. Reisman's argument about the need for many trials?
There's no need for many trials here, any more than, and it kind of depends on what the characterization of many trials is. For example, in Armstrong, what we need to be able to do is show pervasive violations. Just as in Armstrong, the plaintiffs needed to show pervasive violations, and what they did to establish that was to present evidence with 17 different parolees, disabled parolees, and prisoners. One might characterize that as 17 many trials, but that would be missing the point. The 17 different individuals' experiences together show pervasive violations. Hotel-specific violations here together show pervasive violations. These are not difficult analyses either, as opposed to, for example, at Armstrong, where each person's disability would need to be attested to, and the accommodations that person needed would need to be assessed, and what they were provided would need to be assessed. Here, what we're talking about is a simple, discrete set of requirements saying that each hotel needs to provide accessible equivalent transportation and additional support accepted for purposes of this decision. And we showed that more than 90% of HBT's hotels are in violation, and nevertheless, the court found that we had met the requirements of class certification. I see my time is up.
One more question, Mr. Reisman likened this case to Walmart. He said this is the home office, farms those decisions out to the store managers. What they're doing is up to store managers. They don't necessarily know what's going on. The Reed is doing the same thing here. What's your response?
Two responses. First, under Bodasan, there's a non-delegable duty, so if the farm is thrown out and we show that these hotels are in violation, they're responsible.
But why wasn't it a non-delegable duty in Walmart?
And this is the second point, which is to show liability in Walmart, we had to dig in and figure out it wasn't enough in Walmart. It wasn't enough to show that an adverse employment decision had occurred in a particular store. Here, it's enough to show that they don't